Today's subject is going to review a little bit about how the kingdom of Israel functioned. I'm sorry to tell you that some people think history is dull. God is the God of history. He has spoken to us through the history of the Jewish people. He focused his plan and purpose through that nation and their descendants. And it's an absolutely marvelous and brilliant way to do it. Imagine if God had to tell the history of every people on this planet to work out his plan and purpose. You wouldn't be carrying around that little book called the Bible. You'd be carrying around zillions of volumes. Oh, of course, today you put it all on iPad or something, but they didn't have that for most of history. And so God has spoken, and when we're doing Bible seminars and we have people come out of them and preaching, one of the first questions is, why the Jews? Because God focused his plan and purpose through them, through their history. So if you don't like history, you can snooze off, but try not to snore. It's very disturbing to the people around you. For many, many years, having had classes with large numbers of students at times, this is actually a fairly small class. If you're teaching a lower division class, it could have 300-400 people in it. You actually do find occasionally students snoozing off. They generally don't last very long in school. So you don't want to last very short time here. All right, so we're going to study a little bit about Bible history, but we're not going to study it from the viewpoint that you have to remember a bunch of facts. There's not going to be any quizzes here. The reason for studying this is to see the moral lessons, to see the Spirit of God working out through this people and how it applies to us, because the nation of Israel was the ecclesia of God. So this statement, those who don't know history are destined to repeat it, has often been attributed to Winston Churchill, but that's wrong. A lot of things have been attributed to Winston Churchill. The only other person I know who has more attributes than Winston Churchill is Mark Twain. So that's a good one because he's one of my favorite people from Connecticut. The least favorite people from Connecticut is the UConn football team. So Edmund Burke actually said this. He's a graduate of Trinity College in Dublin, and they got a very famous statue of him there. So what does the Bible say? Now, these things took place as examples for us. So the entire Old Testament is not to be discarded. It's there for a very specific purpose. And one of the amazing things that often hits people when we're teaching them the truth, teaching them the gospel message, coming out of Bible seminars, which we've had many, we have them every year in Ann Arbor. We've had them for 20 plus years. Many people follow on for the following lessons. The first thing they say is, in my church, I never studied the Old Testament. God has gotten rid of it. I mean, the New Testament, the Jews are no longer relevant. That's totally untrue. And the first place to take them to is this verse. These things took place for examples for us that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents. Now that's interesting. He says in the Old Testament, the Jews put Christ to the test. How did they do that? Because they sinned against the commandments of God. They sinned against the commandments that were to prepare them for Christ. Nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as example, but they were written down for our instruction. And so when we look at the Old Testament, we have to remember that's a very relevant book. It's just as powerful today as it was then. And the moral lessons and the teachings of the Old Testament have never gone away. God has not changed his approach to the kind of character that he wants in people that he is preparing for his kingdom. He intends to fill the earth with his glory, and he's not going to fill it with the glory of a bunch of real bad people. So if we want to learn about Christ, we can learn about it through the Old Testament. And again, another place to point out many times in the New Testament, in the Gospels, you hear, have you not seen? Have you not read? The Scriptures say. And it becomes a great awakening to people who come from other churches that the Scriptures they're talking about is the Old Testament. So these things are very, very important, the examples that were set. And I notice some of these things that you ought to pay attention to. Israel was God's ecclesia. You are God's ecclesia. I am God's ecclesia. So some of the things that they fell into, we have to be careful not to fall into ourselves. People sat down to eat, drink, and rose up and play. Well, he's talking, of course, about when Moses was at Mount Sinai. But we can do the same thing. The biggest competition today to having Bible lectures, for example, on a Sunday, is not another church. It's the NFL, right? People all want to be watching pro football. So getting somebody out to come to a lecture on Sunday afternoons or evenings is almost an impossibility. So we do most of our preaching work Monday night, Tuesday nights, Wednesday nights, dead time. If you look at this example here, he said they rose up to eat, drink, and rose and play. Now, I'm at a Christadelphian function. You will never starve at a Christadelphian function. Okay? My biggest problem when I go home is to report to my Weight Watcher monitor. You know, one time I weighed 50 pounds more than this, and then Mary and I decided we wanted to die healthy, so we took up bike riding and physical activity and everything else. I'm not exactly skinny, but I'm a lot better shape than I was 10 years ago. And this idea here is one of excess, that this is all people think about. And sexual immorality, yes. Are we falling into that same trap? You know, 50% of the people in North America are divorced. 50%. Now, as a teacher, when I first started teaching in 1965, I could send reports back home to parents. University stopped that about 10 years later because a lot of kids didn't have parents, or the parents, one parent was in California, the other one was in West Virginia, blah, blah, blah. So you didn't know who to send it to. And pretty soon we were told, at least where I at the university, a memo came out and said, please don't tell students that you're going to send any notes home to parents or anything. You're all adults. With the way the world is today, we have no idea where their parents are, and so you'll only get yourself in trouble. So that fall into something else, putting Christ to the test. And grumbling. Wow, I never heard grumbling in my ecclesia. Complaining is probably one of our worst sins. We always look to find fault in what other people are doing. I can tell you this, okay? I've written a lot of stuff. Some of you probably know that for the magazine, for books, and so on. I think it is extremely rare that I ever get a letter saying, that was really nice, thank you. Okay, if I write one thing that people don't like, I get a lot of mail. So I know right away that if you write something important, you're probably going to get grumbling. If you write something boring, no one's going to pay any attention. How do you find the balance? Well, you try. But this sentence here is one to remember. Now, these things written happen to them as example. So what things happen? Well, let's talk about this. Just a little review from yesterday. This is the kingdom of the Assyrians. It went from Egypt, took in what is today part of Iran, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, parts of Turkey, parts of southern, what was once part of the southern part of the Soviet Union, and is now the states of Georgia and Azerbaijan, right over here. So this was their empire. And you wonder, why did they want all of this? Why did they want all of this? Well, for almost four millennia, the Middle East has indeed been the source of world wealth. It fell into disuse for a long time after the Roman Empire. But again, in the world today, it is the center of world wealth. There are more billionaires in this area and going down to Saudi Arabia, Dubai, Qatar, than anywhere else in the world. In the Middle East, it costs 50 cents a barrel to pull oil out of the ground. You just have to drill a hole and it comes up. and it's low sulfur fuel. In the past, this area here was rich because of the Tigris and Euphrates, a very fertile area. The first place in the world that people think that there was cultivation and irrigation works, and people were not hungry anymore because they were able to develop a very good, powerful agricultural system. And the same was true of Egypt. I don't know if, how many of you have ever been to Egypt, but this area has just stunned me along the Nile River, how fertile it is on either side of it. And it's particularly up here with today's modern Alexandria, and down here is Cairo. This area is fabulous in its wealth. And it doesn't depend on the rainfall of this region, which can fluctuate. It depends on the rainfall down here in Africa. And the water comes down, and today it's controlled by the Naswan Dam, and this whole area can be flooded and fertile on either side, and they still have vast irrigation works. So for someone here to control all this area pretty much controls the wealth of the ancient world. And it's so today too. The wealth of the world today, if this area is all controlled, what is the number one asset? You know, in Daniel, it says, have you come to take a spoil? Take the SP off, and what do you have? Oil. And we didn't quite realize some of these things that were happening, because they happen over a time span that's large compared to our lives. And so we're in the middle of a prophetic area, or maybe near the end of it, and we don't always see everything around us. But about 30 years ago, Mary and I went to China. I was a guest of the Chinese Academy of Sciences. I hardly saw any cars. Everybody was on bicycles. And I'm sure that your wife is too young to remember this. All right? This was the same true in the Soviet Union. And when we went to Prague, just shortly after the wall fell. Now you go to China and there's traffic jams. There's Buicks, there's BMWs, there's a wealth of cars and everything. And the need for oil has multiplied. They sold more cars in China last year than the United States, which is not too good from where I live in the Detroit area. All right, and the same has happened to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union used to have just Fiats, which were made in what they call Ladas. This was a car that got fixed quite frequently. It was very unreliable. I can say that because I owned a Fiat once when we were living in Italy. But now, the demand for oil has gone way up in many places in the world, and this area of the world becomes more and more the center of wealth. Okay, so the Syrians had their eyes on it. And you notice lately, and we'll talk about this more later in the week, the world focus on the Middle East is intensifying. And so the Assyrians, starting around here, and we start with Tiglath-Pileser, was one of the first to start carrying away the tribes. And then Shalmaneser again, and they were eating off the tribes at the periphery. First they took three tribes, and then they came down again and took some more. And then they came down, finally, Sargon finishes them off in 721, 720 B.C., and over a 33-year period. But they had started way back, almost from 930 on down, a couple of hundred years, they kept eating away. And what happened was typical of what you see. The two kingdoms were weak. They fought each other. There was internal civil war, and time and again. And they started nibbling off the weaker of the flock. I want you to turn with me to some background material on this in 2 Kings. All right, I think we're all familiar with Ahab. He was a total loser, so we'll put him aside. But let's go to 2 Kings chapter 12, because we talked about Jehu yesterday. And verse 1, 2 Kings 12 and 1. In the seventh year of Jehu, Jehoash began to reign, and 40 years he reigned in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. And every time you have a good king in Judah, the mother's name is mentioned. And I want to point that out. Mothers have tremendous influence on their children. And I can say very thankfully that was true with my mother. My mother was a wonderful Bible scholar. She had a powerful influence on my life. And when I met my wife, I immediately knew that I was going to marry her on the very first date, because she had everything in her character like my mother, except she was a little bit sexy. All right? So that what I looked for in a woman. Now, when I went and told my mother I'd met someone just like her, she was a little skeptical. But once she met Mary, she felt so in love with Mary, she preferred Mary over me, which is probably not hard to do. So Joash did what was right in the sight of the Lord all his days. And Jehoiada, the priest, instructed him. So here was a close relationship between the king and the priesthood. Very, very rare. In fact, if you look all through the books of Kings and Chronicles, the priesthood is hardly ever mentioned. There's only a few cases. And Urijah later is mentioned because he was a very bad priest. Okay? But the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places. So they were still hedging their bets. God has set up one place to worship. Speaking of the unity of God, and yet the people wanted convenience. They wanted to go to the local church down the block. And so they set up high places all over the kingdom and worshiped in ways that were not allowed. I go on to the next chapter, later in this chapter, actually. Chapter 12, again, verse 19. And the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did are not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah. And his servants arose and made a conspiracy and slew Joash in the house of Milo, which goeth to Silah. And so this is how succession happened. Assassination. And it happened time and again. There was no orderly changeover, training of the next generation. It happened by conspiracy and slaughter. Go down to the next chapter, 13 of 2 Kings, verse 13. And Joash slept with his fathers, and Jeroboam sat upon his throne. Now this is Jeroboam the second. And Joash was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel. And Elisha was fallen sick of his sickness, wherein he died. And Joash the king of Israel came down unto him and wept over his face, and said, O my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. And Elisha said unto him, take bow and arrows. And he took unto him bow and arrows. And he said to the king of Israel, put thine hand upon the bow. And he put his hand upon it. And Elisha put his hands upon the king's hands. And he said, open the window eastward. And he opened. And Elisha said, shoot. And he shot. And he said, the arrow of the Lord's deliverance, and the arrow of deliverance from Syria. For thou shalt smite the Syrians at Aphek till they have consumed them. And he said, take the arrows. And he took them and said unto the king of Israel, smite upon the ground. And he smote three times. And the man of God was wroth with him and said, thou shalt have smitten five or six times. Then thou hast smitten Syria till thou hast consumed it, whereas now thou shalt smite Syria but thrice. And Elisha died, and they buried him. So here's a very interesting incident. You would think, why was Elisha very angry? Because when God tells us to do something, he doesn't want a half effort. He wanted him to put his whole heart into it. And when God tells us to do something, he doesn't want a half effort either. He wants us to give everything we have. And so it seems to me that what he saw is that the king went, when he wanted full and complete dedication to what he had told him to do. And I think God expects the same of us. He doesn't expect half efforts. And so what God did over the couple of hundred years is he sent many, many prophets. to both kingdoms. He sent, starting with Elijah, of course we know, Elisha, Micaiah, and then again Elisha, Jonah, Amos, Hosea, and then finally we end up down here with Isaiah and Micah. So we had a whole stream of prophets serving both nations. God was working with his people, working with them, wanting them to do the right thing. And they didn't respond. They didn't do it. And there's these painful, painful words in 2 Chronicles, chapter 36, verse 16. One of the most painful passages in Scripture. 2 Chronicles 36 and 16. And they mocked the messengers of God and despised his words and misused his prophets until the wrath of the Lord rose against his people. And this is a sentence, the rest of the sentence, something stuck in my mind all my life. Till there was no remedy. So God works with us too. And we don't want to see that word said, till there's no remedy. What do we do in the ecclesia today? What do we do in our household when someone is sinning? Do we work with them until there is no remedy? Or do we sort of just pass it on? They're not interested. I can't be bothered. We don't want to see them. There was an ecclesia. Mary and I have lived in a lot of places. Most people can't wait to get rid of us. So we've lived in New York for 40 plus years. We lived in California. We lived in England for 4 years. We lived in Italy. And now we're living in the Midwest, the last 23 years. The occupation I'm in, there's only a handful of places in the world you can really work. And it's been a lot of fun from both the scientific and ecclesial point of view, because I've gotten to learn a lot about the Christadelphian world all over. Some ecclesias are very, very fast to disfellowship someone, because they want to keep their records clean. And one ecclesia I was in, if you weren't there for 3 weeks, they sent you a registered letter. Does anyone remember what a registered letter is? Right. Telling you that if you didn't come the next week, you're going to be disfellowshipped. This is not working the way God worked. He worked with them for almost 210 years. This is approximate date. Some say 931, say 721. But God worked with them and worked with them, worked with them until there was no remedy. And this is for our example. When we have someone that is sinning, when someone is not, we need to put our all into trying to recover them until it's obvious they no longer want to deal with us. It's not something that we pass off. It's not something that we say, oh, I don't have the time. It's something that is absolutely an example from the Old Testament of how God worked with his ecclesia. Okay? And what happened with Israel is very typified by what Jesus said. If a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. And here's what happened with these two kingdoms. Because the northern kingdom weakened, and we found that there was continual civil war between them. And worse, they went and tried to find alliances with the heathen. And a house divided cannot stand. That's a message for us too as ecclesia. Our community needs to be united. We need to realize that we're a very small minority holding on to God's word in a continent with perhaps 330 million people. Are we really doing the best job we can? Too often we're busy preaching to each other instead of preaching to the world. Christ's lesson, when he told this to the Pharisees, Sadducees, they knew the history of their people. He knew what they were talking about. He was talking also to their division between the Sadducees, Pharisees, and their saints. And so what happened to Israel is the weaker ones fell away. They took away the tribes of Naphtali and others on the fringe. And then they came and took the next weaker ones and so on. And that's what happens when the ecclesia gets in turmoil. The weaker ones, the weaker sheep are lost. Okay, let's look at how government should have worked. Hezekiah and Isaiah are the odd couple, not in the sense of being strange, but in the sense of it was an unexpected relationship. That's the primary meaning of odd, by the way. Unexpected. And why was it unexpected? Because if you saw that list of prophets, almost none of them received any good working relationships with the king. It was extremely rare. But Isaiah and Hezekiah had an intimate, close relationship their entire lives. And it was unexpected because, as we'll see later, there was nothing in Hezekiah's background that we would have expected that he could have done anything very good. So how did it work? Executive, legislative, and judicial is the way our government works in the United States. I use the word work loosely. Okay. All right. Sometimes it works. So the president is the executive, the legislative is the Congress, the judicial is the Supreme Court. Almost every democratic nation works that way in various ways. I mean, some countries they would have, of course, a parliament, the executive would be the prime minister, and they do have courts. But that's not the way Israel worked at all. And I do not believe that's the way it's going to work in the kingdom age. God's going to have a far better system of government. He had prophet, priest, and king. And this office will be combined probably all in the presence by the Lord Jesus Christ. So what we see how the kingdom of Israel was supposed to work, I think we're getting a foreshadowing of how the kingdom's going to work. Except the Jews didn't do it very well. So it was a theocracy. Okay, there was no legislative. The law of Moses had the final say on laws. They didn't keep amending the law of Moses. So what happened? Of course, the rabbis did. They created the whole Talmud and made it more and more complicated. Anyone have any idea how many commandments there are that have been added to the Ten Commandments in the priestly code at the time of Christ? 615 new commandments. So when Jesus said, you made the law of God none effect by your tradition, he was talking about all those things they added. And almost all of them were ritual things that had no meaning in terms of refining the character of the Jewish people. The religious side was supposed to be taken care of by the priests and Levites. But what we find in the Old Testament is rarely were the priests effective. In fact, just as Aaron was busy to make the golden calf, we're going to find that some of these priests not only didn't perform the religious rites they were supposed to under the law of Moses, they actively promoted idolatry. And so when the spiritual leaders of a community, whether it's in Israel or in our own community, are not effective leaders in the spiritual matters, we're in trouble. The judicial was performed by the priests in spiritual things and in secular matters by the king. And finally, the executive was the king, and this was mainly militarily and if they decided to build something. But this office, the prophets, they were always appointed by God. And they and their job was to provide the conscience of the nation. And no other place in history, no other nation had this kind of direction. And the prophets were marvelous because they were totally independent of any of these other officials. And they spoke the words of God. Truly blessed. It's something we don't have in our age. So what form of government? Okay, democracy is the worst form of government except for all those others, right? And my grandfather used to say that the Christadelphian community is the worst religion except for all those others. So I'm sure he stole it from Winston Churchill, except when I heard it when I was a teenager, I wasn't aware of Winston Churchill. So how do we run our ecclesias? Well, we do give in to what Robert Roberts says is the evil principle of democracy. But we don't and shouldn't give into it the way the world gives into democracy. Democracy is a very political process, and we need to be aware that we need to have a spiritual process coupled with it, or our community will fail, our ecclesia will fail. So functioning government starts in the wilderness, when Moses sets up the laws of God. And then God chose the leadership. It was not a democracy. Moses confirms God's appointments in similar fashion to the first century church. I know he chose Joshua to follow him, and he says he was full spirit of wisdom, and the emphasis was on the character of the man. So Moses chose Joshua because of his character. And there's no question that this is exactly what happened. And we can compare this, actually, to the New Testament church, and we find out that the New Testament church is based entirely on the Old Testament mode of how to choose leadership. Okay, and these are in Acts. You can take these down, but I'm going to show you on the next slide, so don't worry about it. Okay. And this emphasis on the character of brethren is something that we need to pay attention to ourselves when we choose leadership in our ecclesias. Okay, so here's what he says in Deuteronomy 34:9. And Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses has laid his hands on him, so the people of Israel obeyed him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. So Moses put his hands on him, and I don't know exactly what that conveyed. It simply, to me, conveyed that Moses gave his full blessing to him. Okay? And now, the New Testament quotes follow on subsequent slides, and they show you, interesting, to compare this to how Hezekiah and Isaiah worked together. So the question I want you to think about is, how does our Christadelphian community compare to the way leadership was chosen by God in the Old Testament and leadership was chosen by the church in the first century? Okay. So, in Acts 6:1-7, seven people were chosen to head the ecclesia. Okay. Now, you have to remember, the ecclesia in Jerusalem was not just one little place. It wasn't just the ecclesia in Ann Arbor or the small ecclesia maybe somewhere here in New England. The ecclesia in Jerusalem, we know 2,000 people were baptized in one day. And we know in another passage in Acts, it says they met house to house. So the ecclesia in Jerusalem was comprised of a number of small meetings. And they had a problem. They had to take care of the widows. There was no social security. There was no government welfare net. The church took care of its own. And so the Hellenists were Greek Jews. They were Jews that came into Jerusalem from other parts of the Roman Empire. And when it says Hellenists, that means they were principally of Greek culture. And it rose against the Hebrews because their widows were being neglected in the daily distribution. Gee, imagine that, an ecclesia that was showing bias to one side in the ecclesia or another. I know that would never happen in the world today. But it does point out, again, for our example, that we need to be fair. Somebody moves in from another, and I've been in this position a number of times. You move in from some other area, and you didn't grow up in that ecclesia, right? And the first thing I'd hear if I say, well, let's try this or that, I go, well, if you grew up here, you know you don't do that. I mean, I've heard that many times. After a few years, of course, they're doing what I want them to do anyway, but yeah, that's just the power of, being persistent and annoying, okay? So here, this idea of being fair-minded in the ecclesia is presented to us very well in this little sentence. And the 12 summoned the full number of disciples and said, it is not right that we should give up preaching work of the God to serve tables. So taking care of the daily things in the ecclesia needed to be put in the hands of others. Therefore, brother, pick out from among you seven men of good repute, full of spirit and of wisdom. These are the same words used for Joshua. Exact same words. Where did he get that from? He got it from deep knowledge of how God wanted government to run. And then he says, you pick out. The apostles didn't just say, okay, we choose this guy and this guy. it was the ecclesia that had to make this wise decision. So this is something we can do today. But we will devote ourselves to prayer, etc. And he pleased the whole gathering. They chose Stephen, full of the faith and the Holy Spirit, Philip, Prochorus, Nicanor, Timon, Parmenas, Nicholas. Notice every one of these names is Greek. It looks like the Hellenists were actually maybe the majority. But they chose, every one of the people chosen was of a Greek extraction. And then the apostles confirmed it, just the way Moses did, by laying the hands on. So everything you see here is exactly how Moses passed on leadership. And I think that's a lesson for us. We should be looking for leadership, brethren, who are full of the spirit of wisdom. And once they are chosen, we should lay our hands on by confirming that and giving our support to them. Okay, here's a great lesson. The ecclesia is given, in fact, a whole lesson about how to choose leadership. An overseer, some places call this bishop, right, must be above reproach. And there are many, many lessons here to bear in mind. And I won't belabor the point, but you should go, in our ecclesia, we read this every time we have an election. It may not be possible to pick the perfect person, but we should be looking for the people to lead our ecclesia who fit as much as possible the pattern set down by the Apostle Paul. Okay, and he repeats it to Titus, another good place to read every time your ecclesia is having an election. Okay, as God's steward must be above reproach. He must not be arrogant, quick-tempered, or a drunkard, or violent, or greedy for gain. All right? Hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. Okay? And again, Peter talks about the same thing. Shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you, not shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. So this whole idea of examples is repeated over and over again. And I don't know, somebody else mentioned this. I don't know whether it was Brother Mike or Brother Jonathan. If the Scriptures repeat something, it's very important. God is saying, pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. So this idea of being an example, anyone in leadership position in our ecclesia who is not a good example to the flock is definitely a cause for concern. Okay. Do not forget the gift that was given you by prophecy when the council of elders laid their hands on you, he talks to Timothy. And he talks again of that confirming it and so on, that we may also be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. So what happened in the Old Testament? What happened leading up to selecting these kings? The nation of Israel wanted a king that was like everybody else. They wanted a political leader. They wanted someone who could give them power, who could make their nation successful in a worldly way. Okay? So they went out and they selected a king. The appointments were confirmed, as I said, the same way Moses confirmed Joshua. And it's something that we ought to bear in mind. Okay? Israel was not content being governed by the unseen God. They wanted the king like everyone else. Boy, isn't it nice to be like everybody else? And one thing I can be guaranteed about Christadelphians is that we are definitely nonconformists. We can never be like anyone else. How can a community of 6,000 people who tell 300 million Americans that they're wrong in religion be like everyone else? So we need to strengthen that uniqueness by having that spirit within us that follows after the things of God. The more we conform to the things of the world, the more we're getting away from the Spirit of God. And so Moses prophesied this would happen. So the Jews knew that if they chose a king, they were probably going to run into trouble. He was going to intermarry in alliances with other nations. He was going to have multiple wives and concubines. He was going to be greedy and avarice, and he was going to have pride over his power. Everything that Moses said occurred. Interestingly enough, one talks about David, for example. He had seven wives, and he wanted Bathsheba, number eight. It absolutely blows my mind. I can't even think of having one wife is hard enough to handle, right? I'm sure one husband is hard enough for her to handle. And then he had 10 concubines. Everything that Moses said, I mean, forget about Solomon. He went to total excess. And it destroyed the nation. Okay? And so he predicted this in Deuteronomy 17. And again, you can take that down for your notes. I don't want to belabor the point. So the kings of Israel and Judah eventually did every wrong thing that Moses predicted. And the end result was Isaiah, there can be no peace for the wicked. And we have to bear that in mind. We have troubles in our ecclesias. Sometimes it's because we're being wicked and don't face up to it. It's because we haven't followed the Spirit of God in choosing wise leadership. It's because we haven't confirmed that leadership and been willing to support it when we have good leadership. Leadership is the most critical thing in a community because it is easy for weaker sheep to say somebody else is doing it, so I can do it too. So if you're an elder in an ecclesia and you've set a poor example, it's not just you who are putting yourself in jeopardy, you are putting others in your ecclesia in jeopardy. So ultimately, Judah's failure. So instead they chose a king for all the wrong reasons. Okay, and Saul failed miserably. Why did they choose him? Well, family ties, charisma, smoothness of speech, wealth, political correctness, and worldly achievements are often the way the world chooses leadership. Is that what we do in our ecclesias? Do we family? Oh, wow, family is probably the biggest problem I've ever seen in any ecclesia. Charisma? Well, nowadays, if you don't have a good television personality, you're never going to get elected to anything in the United States. And you have to be a good talker. That necessarily isn't the person who's the best spiritual leader, though. Wealth, somebody who can throw a lot of money around, can really turn an ecclesia upside down. And the rest, I think, are pretty obvious. So what happens? For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. That's what happened to Saul. They chose Saul for all the wrong reasons. Look at the reasons they chose Saul. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, son of Zeror of Bechorath, son of Phihah, Benjamite, a man of wealth. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. And there was not a man among the people who was more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. So why was he chosen? They were rich, he was good looking, he has charisma, and he looked powerful. He was a great leader of the army. Okay? So for us short people, you know, this is definitely bad news, right? In fact, I read one time that in America, the average height of CEOs is about 5 inches taller than the average person. So this is why I've never been a CEO. Okay? But these reasons... are all worldly reasons. And we need to be careful that when we choose leadership in our ecclesia, that we take the example of the Old Testament and throw it out and go to the words that are in Acts, the words that Paul sends to Timothy, the words that Paul sent to Titus, and the words that Paul sent to Peter, because they're all based on the proper spirit of leadership. Okay? So to balance poor judgment of the people of Israel, God created a new ministry. These men were almost without exception ordinary people, not from among the Levites who were originally ordained as spiritual leaders. So a leadership can come by looking at the spirit of a person. Isaiah, who we're going to focus on the rest of this week, was an incredible example of the right choice, the right character, the right leadership, and a man who's working with his king produced a renaissance in that kingdom that should have saved them if it was not followed by more evils. And he is typical of this. And he first appears in the days of King Uzziah. And he was a court recorder or historian. And probably what you read in Chronicles and Kings about that era was written by Isaiah. The other thing about Isaiah is his ministry lasted a long time, perhaps over 60 years. He was the longest preaching prophet. And the rest of the Acts of Uzziah, from the first to the last, Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, wrote. And his father must have been a very spiritual person also, because he is mentioned 13 times. And that's an absolute record. Most ancestors are mentioned maybe once, sometimes twice, but it is emphasized over and over again. So he came from a spiritual family, and Amos means strong, from a primitive root meaning courageous. And that's important too. It's important that leadership picks and nurtures the next generation. Too often ecclesias, people hold on too long. I mean, I've seen one ecclesia at least that had the same recording brother for 40 years. Never trained anyone else. Wanted to hold on to that power until the day he died. And when he died, that ecclesia floundered for years and years and years because there was nobody ready. Nobody ready. And, you know, with the Tidings magazine, we have this problem too. And we've worked very hard. We've had three editors in the last 30 years. But each time we tried to nurture the person before, 3 or 4 or 5 years before the next person retired. And sometimes we're not aware of that. We're not aware that we're not going to live forever. We need to prepare the next generation to take over. We need a continuity. And I urge you in your ecclesia to make sure that the leadership, that you bring along the young people so that the day comes when you can't do it anymore, there's ready someone to step in to nurture the flock and carry on. And I think that's what Amos did. He was definitely a strong, courageous person, and he raised a wonderful son. Just for those of you who like Strong's 553. Okay? So here's what the prophets did, and we will... Oh, this is a good place to stop. They were intelligence operatives. We'll look at that tomorrow. They were the spiritual and moral consciences of the nation. They were physicians' assistants. They healed people, and they performed miracles. All of this came from God. So that there could be... The reason prophets prophesied was to confirm their God-appointed roles. It wasn't to dazzle the people. The prophecy was given to them so that their commission was absolutely certain. But their main job was to stir up the people, to stir up their character. And that's why we have prophecy. We have prophecy, and we should never forget it, because that prophecy is given to us so that our characters are molded so that when Christ comes, he finds a people worthy of his name.